KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, let us now animate a yellow amber alert nationwide. Orange-haired crazy man in clown suit with Dementors driving a USA mobile has kidnapped 3,000 children, 10 newborns at least, and is holding them in despicable circumstances called black op sites by those reporters who have been granted rare access. And we woefully affirm we will not rest till all babies and children have been restored to loving kin with recompense. $130,000 each would be good, an apology and safe refuge. So just before I bring in our perfect guest who knows a fair amount about torture and black ops sites, a little bit of things to cooperate in the larger mythic story. Mars, woofiness, you know, is stationing right now. There are metaphors for each degree of the zodiac, and its image is a man who had for a short time become the embodiment of a popular ideal is made to realize that as a person he is no longer this ideal. Oh, metaphors be with us. There we go. So we honor perfectly welcoming metaphysics of whistleblowing, former CIA agent turned whistleblower John Kiriakou, that we may conjure myriad effective strategies for dissolving the Dementors, war on life, war on democracy, war on women. Welcome, John Kiriakou.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, you know, from our past cahoots, we know you're a man of infinite, myriad, complex perspectives and capacities, and some of them are, you know, mythological as well, that we referenced briefly in our last radio cahoot, yes, what is before us? And it's true that the reports coming out of where the children are being held, you know, being hit for not eating, no mats on cold concrete floors, I mean, just on and on and on. So do you feel that this could be the tipping point? I mean, I've seen it with Trump supporters that I've talked to who are like, oh, no, this is it. This is it. Do you think this is a tipping point?
I actually do think it's a tipping point. And I didn't until day before yesterday when Attorney General Sessions said at a fundraiser in California that those people who identify as Democrats or as progressives and who are opposed to the policy of separating children from their parents are a part of the lunatic fringe. That's right. What he called us, a part of the lunatic fringe, when all of the latest polls say that upwards of 68% of Americans believe that it's wrong to separate children from their parents. So I think that they may have just gone too far this time.
And Jeff Sessions made jokes. He made jokes.
He said, not just Jeff Sessions. It was also half a dozen hosts and reporters on Fox News. They somehow thought this was funny.
I think, you know, because, you know, anecdotal, you know, I know somebody who was staunch Republican Trump person, raised in Germany, many things, you know, and it was yesterday that she said no, because she was an immigrant once too, you know, from Germany. So this, you know, poignancy is kinship and this rousing. And for everybody, you know, there's a June 30th, you know, gathering across from the White House in D.C. and in myriad places across the country. And I think this woofiness. But here's the intriguing thing before us that I want to put to you of many, many strategic responses, and it is very Mission Impossible. But I hosted some weeks back Gary Lockman with his very useful book, Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. And he delineates that the Bannons, the whatever, these are not, these are tutored people in the manipulation of imagery. These are kind of, well, he calls them chaos magicians, you know, with a complete contempt for truth, of course. And they feed on outrage. They have complete contempt for those they deem weak or poor or vulnerable. And so when we go, rah, 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 it, you know, it's like, please don't feed the Dementors, you know. So how, I just toss it to you, this interesting conundrum, you know, how do we spiral and maybe use this opportunity to assume cultural narrative lead, going, come on, all good-hearted people, this way, because they love, you know, the addiction to having an enemy. Trump loves that. They feed on that thing. What do you think of this Catch-22 conundrum?
I think the only way that we can win this and come out ahead is to humanize the problem. You know, the Trump administration, the Republicans, the conservative movement in this country have been so good at controlling the imagery and at controlling the vocabulary as well. They insist on calling people illegal right. immigrants, illegal aliens. Well, I know that they don't like using the term undocumented because they say that just the act of crossing the border is a crime, and that makes them illegal. It's just simply not true, especially in the case that we're watching unfold right now. And it's because these people, the people who have been separated from their children, are here to apply for asylum. Under the asylum laws of this country. Now, the asylum laws are very clear. They allow you to enter the country and apply for asylum after you enter. So the fact that they are on the U.S. side of the border is not a crime. They have every right under U.S. law to be here and to apply for asylum. So we have to reclaim the narrative here. We have to reclaim the vocabulary that's used in the narrative. And that's the only way to get the truth out.
Right. And also to feel wherever we might have been cringing. I mean, this is a dodgy but important thing, too. You know, reading Masha Gessen's piece in the New York Times about, you know, people who oppose Trump say, of course we support, you know, regulation of borders. And she says, why? Why not open right. borders? We had open borders until 1970. You know, and I love the sign at the Women's March in London that said, migration is older than language. And we go, yeah. You know, I mean, in the dream big way, it's like, you know, let's inhale more than what they're denying, you know, in a larger utopian vision of, you know, crossing borders and dissolving them and the welcoming. And I love forever my friend Steve Behrman's quip, the answer to the drug problem, improve reality. We go, well, that's the answer to the immigration issue, too. Improve reality in Honduras and Guatemala, where, you know, I think this is an important part of education, the American populace about, you know, how the U.S., and you can, I want to toss this to you, you know, how U.S. has been complicit in creating the horror, you know, in these countries that has driven people north. You know, what are they leaving and how brave it is and how much the best of humans to go on this 1,000-mile journey to protect your child, you know. So
right.
anything you want to say about what you know about, you know, the CIA's, you know, overthrowing Guatemala, you know, Honduras, you know, and anything you want to, you know, and the creating of gangs. I mean, anywhere you want to go with that, John.
Oh, yeah, we can go several different ways here. First of all, you're absolutely right that all of this is a result of U.S. policy. The reason Latin America, Central America especially, is in chaos is because of U.S. policy,
right.
both intelligence policy and foreign policy. And this isn't something just from the history books. This isn't just from, you know, the 1950s era overthrow of Central American governments. This happened as recently as 2016 when Hillary Clinton refused to endorse the democratically elected president of Honduras and instead turned away when the Honduran elite imposed a criminal former police chief who had been on the payroll of the CIA and imposed him as the new president. Now, he had only garnered something like 46% of the vote. He had lost it fair and square. But when this decision was made, and the actual winners of the election went to Hillary Clinton and said, "You have to say something. You have to speak out." She didn't do anything. And so this is a problem that's gone on for many decades, well over a half a century. You mentioned gangs a moment ago as well. I think one thing that most people don't know, most Americans don't understand, is that MS-13, which is something that President Trump is making quite a big deal about lately, was actually created in Los Angeles. It's a Los Angeles-based gang. So it's not that immigrants or migrants are imposing MS-13 on us. They're not bringing us MS-13 across the border with them as they come. This is a uniquely American gang. Now, certainly, there are large MS-13 presences in Central America, especially in Central American prisons, but they tend to be people who have been expelled from the United States, who joined MS-13 while they were here, with Los Angeles being the center, and then they were expelled. So this is really a creation of the U.S. government.
And I think this is so important because, you know, again, it's spiraling out of the polarity that feeds the Dementors. Did you know is a great way for everybody to step into the conversation if we compost snark. Did you know everything you just said? Did you know why these people are? Because people don't get grumpy about did you know. They go, oh, I didn't know that. You know, but I do want to go back to where you started, 2016, Hillary Clinton and Honduras and Berta Cáceres, who was later assassinated, brought this to the fore, and was outraged at Hillary Clinton's behavior because regret is completely useless. But right now, as we look at SCOTUS and many things that we want to unfurl before us in this hour, we go, it would have been better with Hillary. We wouldn't have known that though. Right. And then we compost that, and you remind us about her attitude to imposing cruel dictatorship on Honduras. And I just want to honor Berta Cáceres too. When I saw, I saw her briefly at the Goldman Awards, where she was awarded, for her bravery and defense of the environment and her people. And after she was assassinated, many of her indigenous allies went on stage and said, "Berta didn't die, she multiplied," right? And it's just, big mother love, big mother ferocity. I mean, that's what's really being unleashed here. Everything in nature, mothers, anybody who's ever been a mother or anybody born of a mother or any, it's like this resonates right in there,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I tend to be a Middle East expert. That's what I spent my career on. That's what my degrees are in. And Hillary Clinton was just as bad in the Middle East. After negotiating a deal with Muammar al-Qaddafi in Libya to give up his weapons of mass destruction, which he did voluntarily, Hillary Clinton launched an attack on him. He was lynched in the streets, and she said, famously, "We came, we saw, he died." So
and then
why
she
would
hit.
You think, why would we think that her policy in Central America would be any different?
Right, and then she had that hideous, hideous laugh.
Yes.
We came, we saw, he died. It was just, we celebrate no one's death. So we heave any regret going, okay, SCOTUS would have been better. No, that's right. No, that's important because here we are. This is the hand we've been dealt. The most outrageous, the children, but anything that's anywhere is everywhere and absolutely bring in the Middle East, and I was just reading your essay on the imminent war with Iran. We will bring that into play too. Because it is the war on life, the relentless desire to drill in the Arctic for no real financial gain. It just is, the Dementors really, they pursue, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by the Gwich'in who live there, and beautiful Sarah James many times on radio, it's called the place where all life begins. It's called the big mother of the earth. So many migrating birds, the yellow goldwing starts in India and flies to the Arctic to give birth and then goes to Borneo, and the people in Borneo base their entire calendar on it, and all this complexity in which the Dementors are like, doom, doom, da-doom, just smush, So, yes, okay. So there is the war on life, the war on women, the war on, you know, just the war on everything. But yes, let's go back. Let's go back to the Middle East and to Iran as well. I do have a bumper sticker, you know, that is the quote from the Delphic Oracle. You know, if the king invades Persia, a great empire will fall. That was the Delphic Oracle being a smartass. But yes, and I was just with many Iranian women at a beautiful Sufi dance council, really, and they love their country. Yes, it's tyrannical, yes, but they love their country, and it's rich and deeply intelligent and cultured. So, yeah, anything you want to remind us about what is in the works, and how can we suck the chi out of that through whatever information? And did you know? Yeah.
Right. Well, I wrote this piece in Reader Supported News on what I called the coming war with Iran. And in my mind, and maybe it's because I'm getting older, but in my mind, the Iraq war began practically yesterday. I at least remember it like it was yesterday. And so I began seeing parallels now with the situation in 2002, and it began to trouble me. I remember when I was at the CIA in 2002, I had just come back from Pakistan. I had been the chief of CIA counterterrorism operations in Pakistan after the September 11th attacks, and I got promoted. And with my new job, I had to sign a series of secrecy agreements. I had no idea what the job was supposed to be, and they wouldn't tell me until I signed the secrecy agreements. So I did that. And when I finished signing the sixth and final one, I said to the officer in charge, "So what's up? What are we doing?" And he said, "Well, next February," he said, "we're going to invade Iraq, we're going to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we're going to open the world's largest Air Force base. Then we're going to move all of our air assets out of Saudi Arabia to deprive Osama bin Laden of the ability to say that we are polluting the land of the two holy mosques." And I was dumbfounded. And all I could utter was, "But we haven't caught bin Laden yet." And he said, "Look, the decision's been made. There's no turning back." Well, I'm starting to recognize things that our government is doing now that we did in the run-up to that Iraq war. We would go indignantly to the United Nations and yell before the Security Council that Iraq was a threat to us. Well, we're doing the same thing with Iran. And then we would pretend like we wanted a UN Security Council resolution, knowing that the Russians and the Chinese would veto it. We're doing the same thing again, especially when it comes to sanctions. So I concluded in this piece, to make a long story slightly less long, that we should really be worried if we see the movement of carrier battle groups into the Eastern Mediterranean, the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, and the Persian Gulf. Because if we begin moving aircraft carriers there, it's because we're going to invade Iran.
So really, the entire populace goes, "We're watching, we're watching." But what you also mentioned in that very important article, we will post it everywhere, as well as your great Twitter feed at John Kariaku, that you say, "I learned that the CIA will push the envelope of legality until somebody in a position of authority pushes back." And you learn that the CIA can wage war without any thought whatsoever as to how things will work out in the end. There's never an exit strategy. Like with the kids, like with the kids, there's
just
no
like
structure to replace that, to reunite them. There's no concern. Yeah. So again, yes. How do we not feed the Dementors? Outrage is appropriate. I think it's a first step. We just don't want to stay in that. Outrage into action, into information, into did you know, into everything else that we can avail ourselves of. But yeah, no. It's you know, and it is the woeful lack of education American governments, not even just the people, but the governance. You know, I don't know if you remember in the lead up to World War I, Gertrude Bell writes to Winston Churchill and says, "Oh, we have our, you know, there's the Muqtada al-Sadr is the firebrand, you know, mullah, and you know, and here's our ally, and here's and it's all the same names because it's their actual biological descendants in the same roles." And it's like, ah, well, I mean, you know this, right? Because the Middle East is your beat.
That's exactly how it works out. You know, you just reminded me of something, too, something that was important. In the run-up to the Iraq War, I was the note-taker in a high-level secure video teleconference. It was being chaired by Vice President Cheney, and it was, you know, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and et cetera. So I was George Tenet's note-taker. And there were two things that were just stunning during the course of this video teleconference. At one point, a senior officer on the National Security Council said that that he predicted that the moment we crossed the border from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait into Iraq, that the Iraqi people would throw flowers in our path. And I remember thinking, are they living in a fantasy land? I mean, even if I had a tyrannical government in my own country, if a foreign power invaded me, I would take up arms to protect my country, whether my government was a bad one or a good one. But more importantly, General Hoare, who was the commander of the Central Command, CENTCOM, was giving his briefing.
Destiny and name.
Yeah, nice name. And during the course of the briefing, he said, if things go as planned, we can be in Tehran by August. And Tenet turned off his microphone, turned around to me, being the note taker, and said, did he say Baghdad or did he say Tehran? And I said, he said Tehran. And he said to me, have they all lost their minds down there? And then he turned back around and turned the microphone back on. And I remember thinking, boy, we are in for some trouble. And we were. We're still in Iraq. I'm talking about 2002. We're in 2018, and we're still there.
Right. And also, you know, because, you know, I've oft told this, but when I used all my frequent flyer miles to upgrade to business class so I could talk to warmongers, my first seatmate was Cisco Systems guy. And he was talking about how they had all the contracts in Iraq for, you know, eye scan recognition and the technology is neutral. I'm going, no, just keep me off it. And I go, when did you get those contracts? And he said, October 2000, right, before the election. Before the election,
was in. There's a famous story about, and it's not apocryphal. This actually happened. That Richard Perle, the famous neoconservative Richard Perle, went to the White House on September the 12th, 2001, and said, "We need to invade Iraq right now." And it was that conversation that got the wheels turning, and. It was only, a year and a half later, less than a year and a half later, we did invade Iraq.
Right, and the most massive, you know, global demonstrations ever. Now, again, it couldn't stop that. And then people going, nobody knew how terrible this would be. It's like, yes, the entire world knew how horrible this would be. But it's also tied, you know, and here's the huge thing before us, you know, the contracts, the money, the sociopathic money being made everywhere, but also the concentration camps being built for children, the plan to have 100,000 people stashed away in concentration camps, the pharmaceutical industry, you know, all the tales coming out of kids given 10 pharmaceuticals because they were deemed psychiatrically unstable because they wanted their parents back. You know, one little girl couldn't walk because she was in a wheelchair because she was so dosed, you know, and all the kids were gaining 50, 60 pounds, you know, and this little boy came out and he'd been sad and now he's really angry. You know, there's that. And then the vaccines, the forced vaccines, you know, it's like, so it's kind of relentless, but I know you're a realistic and an imaginative, you know, person with great linguistic skills and many powerful wizard capacities, you know, so it looks impossible, but we like him, you know, Mission Impossible. We hummed that theme song last time. Dun, 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 dun. You know, to close down these contracts of the people already inhaling vast sums of money for this cruelty?
It's possible, but only with absolutely robust congressional oversight, which we do not have and have not had in many, many years. You know, we look back at the Church Committee and the Pike Committee from the mid-1970s, and we think that's exactly what oversight ought to look like. And it doesn't. The CIA and other intelligence services in the U.S. get away literally with murder because there is no real congressional oversight. If you look at the current Intelligence Committee, chaired by Richard Burr in the Senate, and the former chairman or chairwoman was Dianne Feinstein. Well, Dianne Feinstein was as right-wing on issues of war and peace and intelligence as any Republican on that committee, and we used to call her the CIA's biggest cheerleader on Capitol Hill, even after John Brennan ordered his officers to hack into the Senate Intelligence Committee's computer system. Dianne Feinstein still defended the CIA. That's not oversight. That's exactly what the country needs is oversight.
Right, and then just a little sidebar on this dynamic, you know, again, to compost all these things, it's Dianne Feinstein, kind of like Hillary Clinton, put on these heartless suits of armor, you know, to be like, we're women with heartless suits of armor to that guy. And then we go, no, just stop all that. So, yes, and no, it's Walter Schaub, you know, the former ethics, whatever his title was, you know, who resigned. I do follow him on Twitter. He's really great. So are you. You know, and he said, you know, three checks on the president, the Congress, no, SCOTUS, no, people. All right, it's left to people. Right? That's all that's left right now.
And we're in trouble. We're in trouble.
Yeah. And again, the myriad things that... So we have the conniption fits and the horror and the outrage, which is appropriate first step. That's an appropriate first step. But, you know, and somebody dear to us, you know, in as, you know, everything real and also symbolic, as though it's a tarot card, the sentencing of Reality Winner, right? She was just sentenced to 63 months in prison with then 3 years supervision afterwards, and let's, you know, and what a great name and what a great person, and we just want her return to her dog, and she was held without bail, right, for a year, and this was her best deal, right?
Highly unusual to be held without bail. You know, there were eight of us that were charged with espionage during the Obama administration for speaking out against waste, fraud, and abuse, which is the definition of whistleblowing. Reality Winner is the first person arrested and tried under the Trump administration. I actually had hopes for the Trump administration on this one issue because Obama was so bad. I just didn't think anybody could be worse. And now we have Reality Winner, we have this FBI agent in Minneapolis, and we have Jeff Sessions saying that there are currently three times the number of leak investigations going on at the Justice Department than there were during the Obama administration. So the Trump people are proving themselves to be far worse than even Obama on the persecution and prosecution of whistleblowers. Let's talk about Reality Winner for a moment. I was arrested and charged with three counts of espionage. I hadn't committed espionage, and eventually all of those charges were dropped. Tom Drake at NSA was arrested and charged with seven counts of espionage. All of those were dismissed. Jeffrey Sterling was charged with seven counts of espionage. He maintained his innocence from the very beginning and insisted on going to trial, knowing he had a less than 2% chance of winning. He was convicted, and he was sentenced to 3.5 years. Well, if you've committed espionage seven times, then why are you getting 3.5 years? Because even the judge knew that these charges were bogus. Well, Reality Winner was accused of doing the least of all of us. She was accused of sending a one-page piece of NSA analysis, okay, not something using sources and methods, just analysis, and sending it, emailing it to The Intercept. We can have a separate conversation about the morons that work at The Intercept.
I think we did a little bit of that, but we can come back to that. But also say what it was. The memo was about Russian hacking.
It was about Russian hacking, I would argue two things. I would argue first that the American people have a right to know what that analysis was,
yeah,
because the American people own that information, right? This is something that our government is doing in our name, on our behalf. We have a right to the information. Secondly, I would argue that the information was improperly classified. We have 300 billion classified documents in U.S. government databases, and over-classification is actually a crime in this country. It has been since 2004. You can't over-classify something, but it's never enforced, and it never has been enforced. So I would have argued that if I had been Reality Winner. But in any event, there was one thing that tripped her up during the course of the investigation of her case. On her Facebook page, she had written hashtag resist. Right? Mm. That was it.
Right.
Hashtag resist. The judge said that that was an indication of her hatred of America, and that made her too dangerous to release. And so they kept this woman in jail, awaiting trial, for a year and 3 days. And just now, just this week, she came to a plea of 5 years and 3 months in prison.
Yeah. We're gonna take a very short break right now because hashtag resist, and that reminds me of Turkey, where I just was, and how everything, tyranny is everywhere. But we'll be right back after this very short break. This is the Visionary Activist Show. I'm Caroline Casey. Our splendid guest is John Kiriakou, and we will be right back.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Grab my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our perfect for now guest ally is John Kiriakou, and we're right back in. You were just saying that Reality Winner, the judge, also held her with this harsh sentence because on her Facebook page she had hashtag resist, which he said was revealed animosity to this government. Is that what you just said?
Yeah, it showed that she hated America, he said.
Oh, geez.
And she was both too dangerous to expose to the American people, and she was a flight risk, which was just an utter mystery how he came to that conclusion. But she was charged in the Southern District of Georgia, which has never tried a national security case before. All the rest of us were tried.
Why was she charged there?
That's called venue shopping, because they knew that they could get the harshest possible sentence if they charged her there. And that's what they do. It's one of the Justice Department's tactics.
And it did remind me, you know, just again, sidebar of Turkey, where I just was, you know, a fantastic, deeply intelligent culture run by... So I did not stand up in a code pink outfit and yell on a soapbox, because you can't do that there if you want to. And one of our team, her daughter-in-law, who lives there, had her passport confiscated because she supported the opposition guy. We go, ooh, it's pretty tight. And there were huge, you know, flyers and on buildings, you know, 60-foot pictures of Erdogan, and just this is an everywhere kind of a thing. You know, if anything's anywhere, it's everywhere. So this, you know, the strong man, the uninitiated Mars, the tyrannical dingbattery. But yeah, so Reality Winner. So we wish her well, and somebody's looking after her dog. I hope so. God, there's that.
I've spoken with her parents a couple of times, and they say that she's actually in good spirits, which I think says a lot about her character. I worry about her, the poor thing. I know exactly what she's going through, literally, and it's not going to be easy.
Well, you know, and then maybe she'll run for Congress like Chelsea Manning when she gets out.
Right.
So it might be, you know, again, what would we, yeah, 5 years is, that's long. But you said a very important thing that we really want to amplify. You know, she said, you said that she was sharing our information. It's our national parks. It's our, you know, and I think this is, you know, again, where we got collectively snookered, you know, and let the con man, you know, speak to the disenfranchised going, you are elite and you are wonderful and, you know, whatever it is. And it behooves us to be as skillful in speaking to the ornery, disobedient, you know, spirit in there going, yeah, come on over here. Which Standing Rock really did, you know, come over here if you're, you know, if you're about against eminent domain, if you're, you know, this unites all of us. They did a pretty good job of welcoming, you know, vets and things and right wingers who don't want their property confiscated, and that's really, I think, the dynamic of going, it's our national park, it's our information, you know, it's our tax money being used to torture children. There really is no other word for it. I mean, the horrors unfolding, and the fact that you know, that access is denied, that Congress people show up and they're not being allowed to see, you know, and we just pray for the safety of, you know, the, you know, 10 newborn babies, right, breastfeeding babies taken from mothers whose right. breasts are full of milk. You know, it's like, this is the lowest form of, I don't even know, you know, because anything we compare it to, we go, you know, slime mold. No, that dish is slime mold that actually has a great intelligence and comes together as a community to solve problems. And then just for the metaphysical romping of it all, going, all right, we humans, we need help. I do want to just bring in that, you know, Jupiter, it represents, you know, stories. It's in Scorpio, deep delving. It's stationing now at 13 Scorpio, which is Edward Snowden's moon. And the image for it is telephone linemen at work installing links to other realities, the cosmic switchboard, which is very witty when you think about Edward Snowden. But it is stationing to go forward. So you don't have to believe any of this, John Kiriakou, but if the story says we are coming into an opportune time for a huge renaissance of revelation and whistleblowing, really right around July 10th, you know, and we go, so what would you like made known if we were just to avail ourselves of this possibility?
I think that we have entered into a second phase in our recent history where there is domestic spying going on. We know that local law enforcement and the FBI are constantly scanning our social media accounts, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, Instagram, just looking to see who's a malcontent and who's not. Well, they only admit that when they have to use the information in court during trial. I would venture to say that it happens all the time to everybody. Remember, people thought it was crazy, the notion that NSA was spying on American citizens, because not only is it against the law, but it's a violation of NSA's charter. We had no idea that was happening until Ed Snowden told us it was happening. Well, now everybody knows. I think the same thing is happening domestically. And I think that information is being used against us. I think the law enforcement authorities are lying about the origin of that information. I would like to see all of that come out.
All right, may it be so. And then I did dine. You're going to have to remind me because it's all your buddies. I did dine with Tom Drake and two other beings that you know really well. You know, and we did have a conversation. I'm sorry, say what?
No, I said great. Yeah, Tom Drake.
No, it was great. And I think it was Tom. I think, yeah, the wonderful, and I think it was Tom who said, you know, my mother was an astrologer or whatever, so I'm not really, I'm really into that. I go, maybe we could do a show on the metaphysics of whistleblowing. He's like, absolutely. I think it was Tom. It was a general conversation with all those wonderful, wonderful beings going, right, you know, how do we avail ourselves of the power of revelation? If there is chaos, well, there is chaos magic. They thrive again on this, and really the destruction of the world is Bannon's dream of major war and all of that. So bringing that into play and then yes, that's right. I noticed I was going to send you the article, and I noticed it was on your Twitter feed already, the CBS interview with the former ICE guy, right? Let's bring that up. Okay.
Scandalous. So yes. There's a man who is the former spokesman for ICE. He had been the civilian spokesman for the Department of the Army. He had been the spokesman for NASA. This is a very typical government career. You move from agency to agency, department to department, just looking for that next promotion. He found himself as the spokesman for ICE. He said in an interview yesterday with CBS News that he had been asked many, many times over the years to spin some information. And that's the job of a spokesman, to spin it to make your side look the most positive. But he had been asked by ICE to lie this time. To lie about ICE activities, about this zero tolerance policy, and he said he just could not countenance lying.
Well,
Go ahead.
Wasn't it also specifically about the mayor of Oakland?
Yes. Well, coming to that.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Okay.
There was a, and people may remember. I certainly remember that the mayor of Oakland warned undocumented migrants in Oakland that there was going to be an ICE raid, and there was an ICE raid, and ICE and the Justice Department maintain that people got away who otherwise would have been arrested. Well, the mayor of Oakland has said publicly that there was no inside information. There was just an assumption made that ICE was going to raid Oakland, and they did, because they do this kind of thing. That's their job. So, for whatever reason, after this spokesman resigns, in protest, he is he's accused of being the source of the leak. Well, he didn't even know that until yesterday when he's giving this interview to CBS News. And in the midst of the interview, there's a loud knock at the door, and it's two agents from the Department of Homeland Security wanting to question him on whether or not he was the source for the mayor of Oakland. He said he had never met the mayor of Oakland. He refused to answer any of their questions, which is exactly what you should do. Just refuse. Okay. In fact, I want to repeat that. Don't
yes.
ever speak to a government law enforcement official, ever, without your attorney sitting next to you, because they will lie, they will twist your words, and they'll trap you into saying something that you don't mean. And the next thing you know, you have a felony charge for making a false statement to a government official. So don't ever speak to federal law enforcement, or any law enforcement for that matter, without your attorney sitting next to you.
So that means also when ICE gets on buses in New England and asks to see everybody's documents,
you have the right to refuse to speak to them without an attorney present. You refuse.
And you don't have to show them any documents either.
Right. No, you do not. Now, right. Within 100 miles of a U.S. border, they have the right to ask, but you don't have to show anything.
This is important. Yeah.
The only thing where the law is unclear is at airports. With your laptop, iPad, iPhones, you do not have to provide them with your password, but you may have to provide them with your thumbprint. The courts have not ruled clearly on that. In one district, they said you do have to provide the thumb. In another district, they said you do not have to provide the thumb. And so it's going to have to go to the Supreme Court for a decision.
Well, since it's the index finger that opens the thing, what the hell? Here's my thumb. But yes. But they can take your phone and your laptop. Is that?
Yes, they can take them, but they can't do anything with it. They take them just to be a nuisance, because they're going to hold them for 2 or 3 days, and you're going to be without a phone for 2 or 3 days. They do that just to punish you for not cooperating. But to get into the phone, they have to have probable cause and a warrant.
So
you have the right to ask, what's the probable cause? Why? Why do you need access to my phone?
Well, then you're talking to them, these are etiquette points. We need the John Kiriakou Miss Manners Handbook for dealing. Going, what can you say? What can you not say? But just to go back to the CBS interview with the former ICE guy, I mean, he was in his house, right? And doing the CBS interview when there's the knock, dum 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 dum. Homeland Security interrupted the thing, and did CBS actually film that, or did they film
the whole thing, which was so fortuitous. They filmed the entire thing, and And the ICE agents were very testy with the reporter, because the reporter kept asking, why are you here? Why are you doing this? Why are you asking him these questions? And they kept shouting at her, we're not talking to you, we're talking to him. So it became clear to them moments into this thing that he wasn't going to talk to them. And so they walked away and got back in their big Crown Victoria and drove back to Washington.
Right. Now, did they... Was it just a quirky coinciding that the interview was happening then? They were going to go to his house anyway? Or did they know that the interview was happening?
I think that they probably got wind that there was going to be an interview. Because I don't think they would deliberately make themselves look like fools like they did. So I think they were going there to try to intimidate him. And they just happened to get there when the reporter was there.
That's good. Okay.
Really?
More of that. More of that. May everything we need to know to have a democracy be revealed, rendered harmless, and in the long fullness of time be an occasion for mirth. I mean, there are some books that are useful now. I don't know if you ever read Stanislaw Lem's genius book, The Futurological Congress. Do you know this book?
No, I do not.
It's fabulous. God, he saw it all, and it's funny and dark, you know, but it's a world filled with pharmaceuticals, and even the Polish translation into English is genius, so it's full of mascons. There's, you know, and people are taking pharmaceuticals. If you want to feel anything, if you want to feel anger, you take Furiol. If you want to be literary, you take Proustiac. But in the water, in the air, there are these mascons that people don't know about, and the protagonist, by mistake, takes the antidote, and he sees how it actually is, right? It's a genius book, you know, and it has people being imprisoned and at the borders and blown away. I mean, it's really and it's short too. But again, you know, it's like the mascons, right? And may we all take the antidote and see, you know, and that's really been part of the dedication of your life, really, is to be the antidote to the mascons, right?
You know, I try my best. It's difficult, and the price is very high, but I think I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do what I do.
Well, we talked about this the last time you were on, too, which is, you know, the Mission Impossible and how you loved the CIA at first and, you know, you know, and all of that. And you did go to the underworld and you maybe did some bad things, you know, and then you came back. And, you know, I've met many people recently who have, you know, born in or had really difficult journeys and, you know, and who have, you know, told me of the bad things that they did and then came up and out. And those are the most trustworthy, noble humans now, you know, to go to the underworld and come back, file scouting reports, but also become a, you know, a really stand up, protect life kind of human. And that is part of your mythic journey, isn't it?
It was. And what turned me around really was my time in Pakistan. I went there just after the September 11th attacks, and like everybody else in the building and practically everybody else in America, all I wanted to do was kill Osama bin Laden and capture as many al-Qaeda fighters and leaders as I possibly could. And I actually had great success doing that. I'm not allowed to say how many, but it was many dozens of al-Qaeda fighters, including three senior people, Abu Zubaydah being the most senior. But I realized a couple of things. One, half of them were just kids. They were, you know, 18, 19 years old. They would cry and ask for their mothers, and it was pathetic. But the thing that bothered me the most was that we were scooping up a lot of people who were clearly innocent of any crime. And we didn't care. We just sent them all to Guantanamo. And that's what everybody kept saying. Just put them on the plane and we'll sort it out later. Well, later was a decade later. And these utterly innocent people lost a decade of their lives sitting in a cage in Guantanamo just because we didn't do our jobs appropriately. There was one instance, too, and this I think about this actually quite often. We had done a raid on a building in Faisalabad, Pakistan, and we got the address wrong. And so the father and two adult sons that we scooped up were innocent. They were actually running a girls' school. And when they were brought into the safe house for interrogation, they had sacks on their heads. And I said, why do you have their heads covered? I said to a colleague of mine, and he said, they're al-Qaeda. And I said, have you really never read the Geneva Convention? Seriously? You've never read the Geneva Convention? You can't put hoods on them. Well, this started a real debate there among all these CIA officers. And I was soundly overruled, even though I was the chief. The other CIA officers just would not take the hoods off because they were afraid of being seen and possibly recognized. But my God, if we're going to be a law-abiding country, if we're going to be a country that brags about the rule of law, then let's follow the law. And the law says you can't put hoods on them.
Well, and it's also because you might look into their eyes and see their innocent humanity in there too. You know, it's, you know, and now it's happening with the kids. You know, and just to round it, because it is all one thing. You know, the Reveal, which I love the radio show Reveal, the Center for Investigative Reporting. They're doing such excellent work.
Wonderful.
And excellent work on just really. I love their narrator. I love all the reporters. I love the incredible heartbreaking work they do for all of us, and they were talking to a guy who was on the bridge, right, for asylum. He'd been there 2 days, right, and the guards just block the way and go, "We're full. America is full," right? So his wife and four kids have already gone along, and he uses the reporter's phone to call his mother-in-law, you know, back in Honduras, and she miscommunicates that, you know, his wife is okay with the four kids, and he's like, "Oh, thank God, that's wonderful." And then the mother-in-law calls the reporter and goes, "No, he misunderstood. You know, they've been separated." And she goes back to tell this man that, and he goes, "She's never been away from her four children. What will happen? Oh, my God." And the wife left the message, "Don't come. This is just a place of horror and hell and cruelty. Go back." And he goes, "Go back? Go back to what? I can't go back." So she leaves him on the bridge not knowing what to do. And there, you know, it's pouring rain and there's tornado warnings and everything. And she goes back the next day and he's still there. He's been through tornado warnings and drenched rain. He's in the middle of the bridge, not knowing what to do. And then the next day, you know, he's gone. We don't know. I mean, these stories, these narratives, and it's like, you know, again, you know, and the sneakiness of denying people the access to the legal way of entering, you know, it's just so dementor. Yes, and I guess information, you know, and your ardency and what we can do. And again, you know, because one thing about the Women's March that was huge, and it was the, now it's the second hugest thing, because the largest hugest gathering in Washington was the March for Life from the Parkland Youth, who organized that in about 6 weeks, and it was huge. But in both of those events, there was true atmospheric magic. I mean, there was true collective well-being and collective woofiness and unity. And in the Women's March, you know, it was so good that it changed the hearts of the cops. Everybody was really, you know, it invited the best out of people. And I guess what I want to pitch to you too is that if the Dementors and their, you know, their, well, it goes back to everything, right? Because when Trump said, "I could be whatever, or I could have a heart, but a heart is weak," he said, and we go, now we're back to Skull and Bones, where they did actual black magic rituals in which they said this sense of feeling is weakness, and I kill it now. And then we go, well, we'll give you financial and political power now that you've done that. You know, I mean, so it's all one thing. But it would. It would be that if the Dementors are really inviting, you know, giving license to the worst part of humans, then it behooves us, all of us, everybody, you know, to invite the best, right? Is that part of your strategy?
Exactly right. It is indeed. You know, we have to get the word out, and we have to keep talking about this so that our narrative becomes the narrative of record. We have to make sure that our side of the story is the one that's being talked about. So we just have to keep talking and talk over them if we have to.
Well, and I do, I want to compost the word side. Right, just because I think it's a strategical disadvantage, because right there you're in a polarity, as opposed to a kaleidoscopic thing, you know. But yes, for sane reverence to assume cultural narrative lead, you know, and have that magnetism. Come on, sane reverent people, yeah, over here, you know, those who have a heart, those who have ever, you know, been born or given birth, you know, over here. So yeah, the language part and the language crafting, I think, is part of our dynamic, because it. You know, and how to not have a, you know, a polarizing conniption fit. Although we're all allowed to blow it, you know, and then we get back on. And but also, I am grateful to Michael Avenatti. I don't know what your interesting take is on him. I am grateful. Well, I think he looks like a fawn in Narnia mated with a hyena, because he's got these really delicate features and then this incredible jaw. You know, I'd want him as my lawyer when the guys show up at the door. But I you know, people go, oh, he's a showman. Yeah, he's a competent showman, and he's going to the border and doing pro bono work and, you know, outrage. So does he feel like a colleague to yourself?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, actually. Yes,
yeah.
Because he's increasingly unpopular the more he's out there. But he
is
keeps saying the right things. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's been a real backlash against him because he's a truth teller. And people hate when there are truth tellers.
I love him.
That won't stop talking.
Yeah, and Stormy Daniels, too. You know, I mean, she is very skillful. I follow her on Twitter and Instagram. Because she's very skillful at metabolizing hatred and spinning right out of its clutches. She's really good that way. And also, just as a quirky thing, you know, that the only time we've ever seen Trump look happy in a kind of human way is the photo of him next to her, right? I mean, she spanked him, she made him reel for a second, you know, and then he looked sort of a, more spanking, more of that. But yeah, no, I hadn't realized that there's a huge, you know, backlash against Michael Avenatti, because he's on everywhere, and I'm always grateful. But yeah, so he's metabolizing. Well, he doesn't care, right, about...
He doesn't care one iota. And let me say something, too, about Stormy Daniels. I think many, many Americans have consistently underestimated her. Mm-hmm. And that's at their own peril.
Or benefit. I do not. I'm a huge fan. I'm going to go see her show in Washington. In fact, you know, maybe you want to go too. But anyway, but underestimated her in what sense? I mean, I'm a big ardent fan of Stormy Daniels. But what do you mean?
I think that they've underestimated both her intellect and her ability to take a punch.
Mm-hmm.
She has taken the president's best shot, and she has never withered.
Yeah. No, she's well, you know, and she is a very serious horsewoman, and the quote that I love recently that just floated up from the past, you know, it's a 19th century guy saying, half of the failures in this world come from reining in one's horse as he's leaping. And I love this quote. And there's a fantastic photo of Stormy Daniels, a serious horsewoman and rescuer of horses and a steeplechase person. And it's the most beautiful photo I've ever seen of horse and woman. They are one as they take that jump, right? And I think for all of us, right, I love the quote because it's not all the failures, but half of the failures. And, you know, we might say that, you know, now's the time to not rein in our horse, right? That, you know, it's like, let's be with our ardent, you know, woofy, positive selves, and as the opportunities come along, we're not going to pull back. I mean, well, you've never pulled back. You don't really rein in your horse, do you?
No, I do not.
Excellent. Well, all too soon, we are spiraling out into the memosphere with well-wishing, and thank you so much, John Kiriakou. It's always a delight to, a heartening delight in times of dire beauty to cahoot with you, and thank you for your complex contribution and exhortation.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thanks always to Erica Bridgman. I'm Caroline Casey. You can find me on Twitter at Stand Up Coyote, and also Patreon. You can support, and you can also support John Kiriakou as well. Follow him on Twitter, and we will reconvene next week. Thank you, team.
Are you tired of The Matrix?
The movie?
No, not the movie, but the one you're living in. If so, then hang out with your friends at The Full Circle.
What's The Full Circle?
Full Circle is a radio show written, produced, and directed by apprentices right here at KPFA. We'll bring you everything from the obscure to the obvious, the hidden and the blatant, as well as all things in between. So be informed. Hear about your world community every Friday night from 7 to 8 p.m. on 94.1 FM, where we'll serve you the red pill with love.
Do you want to help KPFA meet the needs of the community it serves? If so, we welcome you to join KPFA's Community Advisory Board, also known as the CAB. They are currently in search of talented and skilled individuals who can help gather listener feedback for KPFA's local station board. Their goal is to help KPFA improve its programs in public affairs, culture, and music. They also help in community outreach. For more information about the CAB, please visit kpfa.org, where you will find them at the bottom of the homepage. You can also contact the CAB at cab.kpfa@gmail.com.
You're listening to KPFA 94.1 and KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, and K248BR 97.5 in Santa Cruz. You can stream KPFA online or listen to our archive shows anytime